This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
What's up, preacher man?
President Donald Trump signs a new executive order regarding religious liberty. What does it contain, and how will it affect your life? We find out on The Patriot Preacher. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to The Patriot Preacher, covering the news from a Christian perspective. Great to be with you on this Friday morning. It is finally Friday. The weekend is quickly approaching. It is upon us right now. So, did want to get into the news. This is big stuff from, you know, the Patriot Preacher standpoint, because it's where religion meets politics, and so it's always something that I tend to jump on when I see that there's this this intertwining, as it were. Maybe that's not the best way to describe it, but a opportunity, a event where religion and politics are discussed in the same breath is usually where I kind of specialize. So yesterday, for those of you who may not remember, we actually talked about it a little bit on this program. Yesterday was a National Day of Prayer. Excuse me. And I say a National Day of Prayer, not the National Day of Prayer, because there's actually a lot of precedent historically for there being several National Days of Prayer, including, a lot of people don't know this, but Thanksgiving. The original name for Thanksgiving was actually a National Day of Prayer and Thanksgiving. So there are several National Days of Prayer. Yesterday happened to be one of them that is recognized by the federal government, not as a federal or state holiday or anything, just a day for everybody to focus on prayer, focus on spirituality, a recommendation, as it were. Now, yesterday on one of the National Days of Prayer, Trump signed a religious liberty executive order. And so we're going to look into that, what exactly it means, unpack it, what does it do from a practical standpoint. So what this executive order deals with specifically is the Johnson Amendment. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with the Johnson Amendment, it's from 1954. It essentially says that if churches engage in some kind of political back and forth, then they lose their tax-exempt status. So if you are a church, let's say that you're, you could actually just be a member, but especially if you're a employee of said congregation. So if you're a minister, a youth minister, the church secretary, any of those things, if you come out and as a member of the church, not just as a private citizen, because of course you're allowed to give your own opinions, but if you as the member or the representative of a church come out and endorse a particular political candidate or even a specific political agenda, then you can be called into question by the IRS. And you can lose your 501c status. Now, you're perfectly welcome to use your church to do that if you really want to. What the Johnson Amendment does is it allows the IRS to investigate your church if you do so and decide that you are no longer a qualifier for the tax-exempt status that churches enjoy. So there's a couple things that lead into that. It specifically does prohibit churches from getting the wording of the law itself is directly or indirectly involved in politics. And this was a big deal for a friend of mine, a dear friend that I have that lives in North Alabama now, but her hometown was actually in Tennessee. And Tennessee had a state proposal called Amendment 1 that was supposed to, because just to go into a little bit of history about it for our neighbor to the north, they had become kind of a sanctuary for abortions because of the way their abortion law works. It was a little bit easier to get an abortion in Tennessee than it was in the surrounding states, especially considering they were in the Bible Belt in the Southeast. And so you had women actually driving out of state, driving to Tennessee specifically to get abortions. And what Amendment 1 did is it helped strengthen the laws against that. And this particular friend of mine, her congregation was actually called into question, and there were lawsuits filed and people trying to sue to get them to lose their tax-exempt 501c status in order to silence them politically because they had signs out that said support Amendment 1. Now, it would have been one thing if they supported an actual candidate, but they didn't. They were advocating for a policy that they believed would have been in, you know, the church essentially all agreed was congruent with their beliefs about abortion being wrong and wanting the state that they live in and operate in as a congregation to add a little more scrutiny to abortion if that were possible. And so they weren't even necessarily endorsing a candidate. They were just endorsing an amendment. And in doing so, that was called into question. Now, they didn't wind up getting investigated by the IRS. It really didn't wind up going anywhere. But that is something that you have to be cautious about, because there have been congregations that have been called into question on things like that. There's a difference in that and actually being investigated by the IRS, and we'll get into that in just a second. Now, when this particular religious liberty executive order was announced, the ACLU, in typical ACLU fashion, was already chomping at the bit to try to get to a lawsuit. In fact, they had already threatened a lawsuit. They were ready to move forward with that. But upon seeing the actual text of the law, even the ACLU came out and was tweeting the other day through their official Twitter feed. It was like, we thought we were actually going to wind up filing a lawsuit against Trump this week. Turns out there's not enough there to file a lawsuit on. And so the reason for that, and the reason I lead with that in telling this story, is it turns out this executive order is essentially a giant nothing burger. It really doesn't do anything to protect religious liberty. What it specifically does, it does pertain to the Johnson Amendment, but specifically what it does is it says to the IRS that they don't have to investigate these churches when they have these things that are, according to them, questionable, that they think they might should lose their IRS 501c status, their tax-exempt status. But the thing is, that's not something that happened real often anyway. In fact, it's been a very, very long time since that has happened. It does give the IRS some leeway to not, quote-unquote, enforce the law. But the thing is, with that law specifically, it's one that kind of never gets enforced anyway. In fact, since it passed in 1954, only one church has ever lost their 501c status. And that was because back in the 90s, they took out a full-page newspaper ad for Bill Clinton. So, granted, I don't think they should have lost it for that either, because I don't like the Johnson Amendment. I think it's a stupid law, and I think it's incongruent with our values of religious freedom. But at the same time, this executive order doesn't really do anything to prevent that. Now, when we're looking at this, just kind of taking a step back and looking at it, there have been thousands of churches just in the past few years that have publicly endorsed a candidate basically daring the IRS to take away their 501c status. The IRS has essentially just not done anything about it. So Trump basically issues an executive order, which, I mean, there's nothing unconstitutional about it, saying the IRS doesn't have to be real strict on this to a law that they're already not real strict on. So, I mean, at the end of the day, it really just doesn't do much. I don't think anything in anybody's life is going to change, or any church or religious organization is going to be protected because of the executive order that Donald Trump signed. So, something to consider. We'll talk a little bit more about this and talk about the Johnson Amendment itself when we come back in just a second. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to comment.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The Bible is a book worth more than all the other books that were ever printed. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. Call in 860-1440 if you want to weigh in. And if you do call in, don't forget we still have that giveaway of the Montgomery Biscuits. We've already given away 4 tickets this week. We have another 2-pack for you today. So if you call in, want to comment on something, we'll put your name in the hat and you could win a Biscuits 2-pack for May the 12th to see them play the Chattanooga Lookouts.
That's a week from today.
That's right.
Oh, by the way, happy Cinco de Mayo.
That's right. Cinco de Mayo. There's going to everybody drive home safe. Get a designated driver. Little disclaimer right there.
Well, I'm going to go do lunch. I usually, at the most, one margarita. Perhaps if somebody buys,
I'll have a burrito, but I'll have a Dr. Pepper with it. So, but anyway,
I am going to have some kind of. I just haven't decided where.
That is the big question. Well, getting back to our subject, I wanted to use this as kind of a launching point, because the Johnson Amendment is something that I am vehemently against. My big problem with this executive order is not that it tries to take the teeth out of the Johnson Amendment, it's that it doesn't succeed in doing so, that it essentially doesn't do anything. And so that's really my big beef with it. So I do want to address this question to you and ask you to think about it. Should the Johnson Amendment exist? Should churches be strictly prohibited from mentioning politics, endorsing a candidate, endorsing a policy? Because that's something that's been a part of our country now for over 60 years. So we need to, I think, reevaluate and ask ourselves if this is something that we should be doing. Well, I think that the entire foundation of the Johnson Amendment is completely built upon a lie, because it's built on the manufactured legal philosophy of separation in church and state. Now, when we're talking about church and state, there is some legitimacy to it, but not the way that it's been presented. See, the whole separation of church and state thing actually comes from people think it's in the Constitution. It's not. It's not in there even once. The separation of church and state comes from a letter that was taken from Thomas Jefferson, who, don't get me wrong, if we're going to talk about founding principles, Thomas Jefferson is one of the go-to guys, but at the same time, they credit him as being the one who put separation of church and state in the Constitution, which is funny for two reasons, because A, he didn't put it in the Constitution, it's not in there, and B, he was in France the entire time the Constitution was being written. He wasn't a part of the Constitutional Convention. So Jefferson couldn't have put it in there, nor could he have put anything else in the Constitution. Anyway, that being said, it was actually taken from a letter by Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptist Association. That's the history of it. And in this letter, he talked about the wall of separation. But what he was doing was assuring the Danbury Baptists that the federal government would not infringe upon their rights, because they were asking him a specific question about the federal government and whether or not they could continue teaching what they were teaching. Because you have to keep in mind, it was a different world back then. They were afraid that by teaching their doctrine, or by saying, based on what they were saying, they were afraid that they would be persecuted by the government. Jefferson was assuring them that the government would not interfere with their rights of free speech or to teach what they wanted to. See, now separation of church and state means the church cannot have any influence over the state. But when it was written, the person that they're citing as being the one who, quote unquote, invented this doctrine, which he didn't, that actually was the exact opposite. He was saying that the state cannot influence the church. And so they've completely reversed it from what it was intended. And the wall of separation that Jefferson was talking about is actually derived from a popular Reformation movement teaching, which he would have been very familiar with in that day. You have to keep in mind, the Reformation movement was not that long ago when Jefferson was alive. And so a lot of these Reformation movement teachers, they talked about the wall of separation because, keep in mind, where were they coming from? England. And England, when they were there, had the Church of England. Now, you could be a different religion if you wanted to, but the Church of England was the official state church, and the state and church were intertwined. The effective head of the Church of England there were other officials, but really the king was the head of the state church. And before that, of course, you had the Catholic Church in England, and still did in Spain and many other European countries, to where the state and the Catholic Church were intertwined. And so you had this unholy alliance, as it were, to where the governing powers and the church were essentially exactly the same thing back in the day. And so Jefferson was assuring them that that's not how it worked in America, and their beliefs would not be infringed upon because the state didn't like some of the things that they were saying. Now, the churches of Jefferson's day were gathering places for political debate. If you lived in a town and you wanted to debate politics, you went to the church building, and it was usually the preacher leading it. So the idea that churches ought not be able to even talk about politics or publicly discuss or advocate for a specific policy, that's exactly the opposite of the way it was in our founders' day. That was never the founders' intention. Now, whether or not you agree with that or not is a different matter entirely. But the fact is, the churches were doing it back then, and they had every right to do it. And this was not seen as something to the founders to be afraid of. In fact, Jefferson publicly accepted endorsements from ministers and churches often. This was a common practice for him and other politicians of his day. He also had sermons preached against him in many churches. And not only did he not try to bring the government down on people or try to shut them up, he also didn't even react to them, didn't even publicly talk about it. And that partly went back to Thomas Jefferson's personality, which I don't have time to get into the depths of it right now, but he had a philosophy of, you really don't say anything to the people that don't like you, and you just live your life in such a way that you prove them wrong by your actions instead of arguing with them, which is an interesting policy to have, and I do think it really worked for him eventually. But the point is, he had a very public reason to personally go against churches, because there were a lot of, especially New England churches, that hated him, tried to keep him from getting into the White House, and he never made any attempts to shut them up because he believed they had a right to talk about politics if they really wanted to, which flies in the face of the Johnson Amendment. He also approved federal funding for missionaries, and get this, for a large portion of our history, there was a weekly Sunday worship service held on the floor of the House of Representatives. And who started that? Thomas Jefferson. He's the one that began that church service, which continued well into the 1900s. And so the idea that Jefferson was an ardent separatist when it came to church and state, that he always wanted them to have nothing to do with each other, no interaction, there's absolutely no historical basis for that. That's historical fantasy, as it were. Now, personally, I'm just giving you, at this point, what I would do in this situation. Personally, I have never endorsed from the pulpit, and, well, actually, I don't even really endorse on the show, but I don't endorse specific political candidates. I do endorse philosophies. I don't think preachers should endorse candidates. That's just my personal belief, but I think they have a right to if they want to do that. Now, unfortunately, our churches have failed woefully to endorse the principles and teachings of the church when we're engaged in politics, electing officials, voting for certain issues. I think our churches have failed to endorse the principles that a Christian should adhere to when voting. But that's different than endorsing a candidate. The principles I think we should be talking about, and the Bible is pretty clear on that. All right, we'll be back. Take it away, Rush.
And I'm getting weary. How far is heaven?
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 3:20. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. I just noticed that. It's funny that you played that intro because the girl that did that recording, tomorrow is her wedding day.
Oh, well.
Yeah, so it's funny that...
I don't know her, and I didn't...
Right, well, you wouldn't have known that. But yeah, tomorrow she's actually getting married. So congratulations to my buddies Jenna and Sean on their upcoming nuptials. I won't be able to make it to the wedding, but I did want to say that to them.
Well, this has been sort of a month of weddings for people we kind of know, you know, our program director.
That's right. The great Joe Hunk, who's the host of The Fallout, he actually got married last Saturday. So I guess May's popular for weddings. I always thought June was the wedding month, but I guess I guess this time it's May.
Maybe you'll take the plunge.
not anytime soon.
Not that you know of.
Well, I wouldn't want to get married in June because my birthday is in June.
But, oh, good.
Yeah, so I'd want to space it out from that. But regardless, so I did want to mention this before we do get back into the news. Talladega is this weekend. Big event here in the state of Alabama. Lots of tourism. So don't miss Dale Jr. in one of his final races at the Talladega Super Speedway. Call 877-GO-TO-DEGA. That's 877-GO-TO-DEGA, DEGA, or visit TalladegaSuperspeedway.com now to get your tickets. So be sure to check that out. Big event here in the state of Alabama. I know there's a lot of NASCAR fans out there. So everybody have fun, be safe, and, you know, hopefully you'll get to see lots of wrecks and all that good stuff, all that entertaining. Hopefully everybody's safe, of course, but, you know, that's what I like is watching them plow up the wall.
You like to see you like to see the carnage as long as they're not a human involved. I mean,
right.
You know,
I don't mind the cars getting
tore
up.
Yeah, really.
Right.
They can afford it.
But, you know, I have to say, and, you know, you have to give credit where credit is due. The engineers that have designed those things, they've made them to where you can plow up a wall at 200 miles an hour, and usually the guy winds up walking off of it. They've made them very safe, and you have to give them credit for that.
I don't see how that happens, even with with the best engineering and the best minds in the world, they're still humans, and
yeah,
you just would think there'd be some fallibility. But the Zoma, yeah, I've seen on YouTube, you can watch all kinds of crashes, and it's sort of like you can't take your eye off of it, especially if you know nobody's
right.
going to get hurt. You know, how did so-and-so walk away from this? But I don't want to watch people get hurt.
No, of course
just,
not.
Just the cars.
And I just want to give a lot of credit for that, and we've made so many sports safer. There's always going to be a risk in sports, but, you know, football, baseball, we've done so much to make those sports a lot safer, and I love that because there's a lot less chance one of the athletes or one of the people are going to get hurt, and that's really great that we can enjoy it that
since
way.
Since you speak, and one final thing, since you speak of athletes in other sports and people getting hurt and even the head injuries in football and all.
Right, concussions, whatnot.
I always think especially of race drivers and boxers, people, and so all of them really know there's an inherent danger in that. So,
oh, of course, they're taking a risk.
They choose to do it. I'm
right.
not trying to be insensitive to somebody who later in life suffers brain damage or Parkinson's or whatever. That's sad, but they knew going in.
Right, they did know, and that's the thing. You do know going in. You're assuming a risk when you engage in a sport, especially a contact sport. So speaking of risk, and I think that it's appropriate that we hedged it that into that since we were kind of talking about healthcare. So the new healthcare bill, we talked about this just a touch yesterday. We were talking mostly about pre-existing conditions, and I want to go to the broader scope of what this healthcare bill is and what it does, because the pre-existing condition things, of course, is important. That's a big factor in it. Like I said, it's probably the most important factor politically. So let's look at this. The Democrats are now saying that this is a massive transfer of wealth, and that's one of their big criticisms of it. So let me get this straight, Democrats. When you imposed Obamacare and raised taxes on people to give to poorer people that couldn't afford health care, that wasn't redistribution of wealth. That wasn't a transfer of wealth. That was social justice, and that was, quote-unquote, the right thing to do. But now that you're letting those same taxpayers, because this does eliminate the Obamacare tax, now that you're letting those same taxpayers keep the money that they had 7 years ago, keep their own money that they made and earned, that's a transfer of wealth. So think about the mental gymnastics you have to go through to get to this point. It's a transfer of wealth to not take money from people. That's like saying, I did you a favor by not picking your pockets. It doesn't make any sense. It's not a transfer of wealth. If anything, it's ending a transfer of wealth because the person who made the money is keeping the money. So they can call it a transfer of wealth to the wealthiest amongst us if they want to, but you know, when you're observing it and actually looking at it objectively, whether you like it or not, it is not a transfer of wealth. It's keeping wealth where it was originally. And so you're not even returning. It's not like they're handing it into the government and then the government is handing it back to them. They're just not taking it in the first place. And so the idea that the Obamacare taxes, getting rid of the Obamacare taxes is a quote-unquote transfer of wealth is simply not honest. There's no truth to it. It's just a interesting talking point for them that they're doing to try to whip up their base and scare people about it. They're not giving money to wealthy people. They're just not taking money from, and this is actually coming from CNN, not exactly the most conservative news organization, not the furthest left either. But they said the winners in this new healthcare bill is going to be wealthy people, but it's also going to be middle class. The middle class people that are paying the Obamacare tax that are funding this, they're going to be keeping more of their money on that. So actually, this bill is quote-unquote good for them. Now, the thing about that is Donald Berwick, who was one of the I don't want to say puppet master, but definitely one of the people who helped orchestrate and draft Obamacare. He was the head of Medicare and Medicaid. He was overseeing those programs, and he's the one that helped write the Obamacare law. He wrote a big portion of it. He's the one that said that Obamacare had to redistribute wealth to work. This is the man who wrote the bill. He's saying it's redistribution of wealth. It's not just a Republican talking point. He said that it's about redistribution of wealth. It's taking money from some people to give to other people, that which they did not earn. And so the whole purpose of Obamacare, and one of the things that it accomplished in their mind, was that it took money from some people to give it to other people. Now, we all knew that. Anybody that was paying attention knew that. But the point is, they knew it too. That's the way they designed it. They wanted it to be redistribution of wealth. And so, in their mind, it is a quote-unquote transfer of wealth for my money to stay in my pocket. That's how they see it. That's how they're viewing this. That's how they're selling this to the American people. Now, if you're paying attention, the definition of entitlement is thinking that you have a right to something without earning it. So if you believe that you have a right that you are entitled to, that you deserve something, as it were, without doing anything to accomplish it, to achieve it, to earn it, then that is by definition a sense of entitlement. Now, you are entitled to certain things. You are entitled to free speech, for example. You're entitled to, when you say something, nobody attacks you, assaults you, nobody does anything to you to try to silence your free speech. So you are entitled to that, but you're not entitled to other people's stuff. That's not in the Constitution. That's not a part of natural law. That's not a part of God's law. That's not found anywhere in our founding documents. And so this redistribution of wealth, if that's what you're advocating for, that is by definition an entitlement. So, you know, when you're looking at it that way, when you're looking into, when you're asking the question of what this bill actually does and the way that it works, that's the conclusion you have to draw to. Before we go to a break, let's go ahead and take Chuck on line one. Good morning, Chuck.
Seth? Yes, sir.
Okay, just got the wrong name. That's fine. What's on your mind, Seth?
I was wondering how this new health care bill is going to affect young 20-year-olds at work.
Well, actually, though, granted, I've got very mixed feelings on it, and I'm about to get into that. It actually, according to most people that have been observing it, it's going to help them in a way. Because you're no longer, if you've got the whole, for example, the pre-existing condition thing, it's trying to limit the amount of the premium increases. It's trying to remove the 30-hour limit, which is something that I'm very much looking forward to. There is speculation that it's going to get rid of the 30-hour law that essentially says if you work over 29 and a half hours, then you have to be paid full time. So it gives 20-year-olds that are working more options. It definitely doesn't solve the problem, but it's a step in the right direction for those people.
Thank you very much.
You are most welcome. You know, that's something that is very near and dear to my heart because I am a 20-year-old that works. So,
well, no, you're not.
Yeah, I'm 27.
Yeah, but you're not a 20-year-old.
Well, no. I'm sorry. I took that to mean people in their 20s.
Yeah, that probably is what he meant. By the way, that was my fault. I wrote down Chuck.
Oh, don't worry about that, Joe. We as long as we've got it down right.
And by the way, he does want to be in the drawing for the tickets.
Excellent. All right. So, Seth, we will have you in the drawing for those biscuits tickets. We'll see what we can do about that. Hopefully, we can get those to you. Thank you so much for your call. Great question, because this is going to affect a lot of people. There are some people that it will probably affect adversely, depending on how you're looking at it. There are some people that it's probably going to help. So we're going to try to break that down, do the best that we can to give you the analysis of that when we come back. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. Out all night long.
She makes sweet rock and roll while she listens to the... This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Governments could not give the rights essential to happiness. We claim them from a higher source. From the King of Kings and the Lord of all the earth, General John Dickinson, signer of the Constitution.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. Don't forget to listen to News Radio 1440 all this week, which I guess is today. This is an old copy. During the Patriot Preacher for your chance to win a pair of passes to see your Montgomery Biscuits take on the Chattanooga Lookouts on May the 12th. So you can listen for the rest of the show. We've got another pack to give away. Call in, put your name in the hat. We'll try to get you those biscuit tickets if you're interested. We will get those to you as quickly as we can. So we do have one more pair of tickets to give away. So be sure and call in at 860-1440. Be on the air and get your name put in the hat for those. Now, we were talking about the health care bill and this new health care proposal by the GOP. I'm going to go ahead and give you my analysis, my opinion on it. This bill is much better than the last one. I will grant you that. But it is nowhere near a repeal, not even in the same zip code as a repeal. Most of the provisions that were jacking up premiums, they all stay in place, or at least they stay in place conditionally. And so this bill is a massive step in the right direction, because the last one was essentially just, I mean, it was Obamacare. You could say it was the GOP version of it, but really all it did was help out the insurance companies. It really didn't help. It really didn't move the ball away from Obamacare. I can understand someone, a member of the House, a member of the Senate, supporting this one because it is a step in the right direction, even if it's not anywhere near what they promised to do, because it's not anywhere close to a repeal. But there are some provisions in it that work and are good. The first one that makes it drastically different actually does refer back to what we were talking about yesterday with pre-existing conditions. But here's the thing about that. It does not eliminate the pre-existing condition, quote-unquote, protection. And I use that sparingly because you're protected from being discriminated against with pre-existing conditions, but if you're priced out of the market because everybody's premiums are through the roof, I don't see how that helps much. You're getting health insurance, but you're not getting health coverage, and there is a difference. So with this bill and the way comparing it to the last, it does allow for that to be possible. But the way that it works is it is still the de facto law of the land. In fact, while it is the de facto law of the land, it's the default setting, as it were. So the pre-existing conditions things already exist. The only way you can get out of it is if your state gets a waiver. In other words, your state has to go in and put in with the federal government for a waiver to not protect the pre-existing conditions, and then the federal government still has to approve it. So the idea that this eliminates the pre-existing conditions thing, that's not the case. And the thing is, the vast majority of states are not going to do that. And even if they do, our markets are so interwoven that premiums are still going to be really high. And part of that is because there were other conditions in that. But at the same time, that was one of the big things. I would say it was the primary thing that was driving up cost. And so if this stays in place, then that cost is not going to be dropped down any. And when you're talking about the states, here's what's funny to me about it. This was the thing, the fact that the pre-existing conditions had the potential to not be covered in all states because states could apply for and get approved for a waiver. That was what kept the moderate Republicans from supporting it. Think about that. That is too far to the right for them, that states can put in an application to get a waiver to not protect for pre-existing conditions. That to them is too radical and extreme. And what does that tell you? The moderate Republicans, they're just Democrats. That's all they are. They are, in essence, most of them, if you're looking at a political spectrum, they're a 1960s JFK Democrat. They like big government. They like entitlements. They want the government to spend a lot of money. They may be a little bit more corporatist than the Democrats, but they're the Democrats. They weren't trying to get rid of Obamacare. They don't believe in free markets. All they are is the Democrat wing of the Republican Party. And if just states, first of all, they don't care about states' rights, because if they did, they would support this regardless. But they're so terrified that their state may apply, and whether they get approved or not is still up to the process, but apply for not covering pre-existing conditions from the federal government, that they can't even vote for that. So all these guys are. They can give lip service to wanting to get rid of Obamacare, but they want Obamacare. This is the easiest thing to get rid of, in my opinion, with Obamacare, and they're not even willing to undo that. They're not against Obamacare. They just said that to get elected. So I don't understand how this is controversial, especially to someone with an R behind their name. Now, the good thing that it does, and I do want to give it some praise, because it does do some things well. It does eliminate the Obamacare taxes, the vast majority of them. So it gets rid of the taxes that were being pumped into it, because they did have to do a tax increase to help fund Obamacare. This eliminates part of that tax. Now, the excuse for this being nowhere near repeal, the fact that it actually does very little to change Obamacare, the vast majority of Obamacare, I would say anywhere from 85 to 90% of Obamacare stays in place, even if this bill passes as is, which is going to get watered down in the Senate, so that percentage is going to get even higher. But the excuse for it not being all that effective is that, well, this is phase one. We have a three-phase plan. We're going to pass this one, and then gradually we're going to pass phases two and three. Well, here's the problem with that. A, you can write a bill that has a timeline in it. If your plan is to repeal Obamacare, all you have to do is write a bill with three phases already in it and say when those phases are going to begin. You don't have to pass them one at a time. In fact, that's exactly what Obama did with Obamacare. It didn't get fully implemented until 2014. And so you can set time limits within a bill. Why don't they do that? And secondly, if they're having this much trouble, if they're barely passing the House, much less the Senate, by the skin of their teeth with this limp noodle bill, what do you think phases two and three are going to run up against? If they're really as good and get close to repealing Obamacare as people are saying, do you really think that's going to pass the House and the Senate when this one just passed by a couple of votes? There's no freaking way. So this is a half-hearted attempt, and I think it proves that the vast majority of Republicans, they like Obamacare, they just want to be in charge of it. It has nothing to do with them being against government-controlled health care. That's the way I see it. Step in the right direction, but nowhere near where we need to be. We'll be back. Hour two is coming up.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
What's up, preacher man?
It's Friday, so we've got another top 10 and a few special guests. All that next on The Patriot Preacher. Hey, welcome back, everybody. You are listening to The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to call in, let me know what's on your mind. It is Friday, so we've got a new top 10 and a special treat for you. We've got a couple of guests in the studio with me right now. And by in studio, I mean in the metaphysical sense. They're joining me via Skype. So we have a couple of guests here. First off, we have Chris. So tell us a little something about yourself, Chris.
Well, there probably isn't a whole lot to say. I've been on a couple times before, so I consider myself a friend of the show. I write for RestoreOurFaith.com, and I'm an engineer by trade, so I'm definitely not a radio personality, but I might still have a face for one.
That may be the case, but yeah, you guys probably remember Chris. He's been on the show a few times, RestoreOurFaith.org, which is one of the websites that I write for. You can check out my articles or his. Both great readings, so check those out anytime. And we also have another one of my buddies from my college days, AJ, joining us this morning. How you doing, AJ?
Doing good. How about you?
Doing great.
Yeah, I've never been on the show. You've mentioned me a few times. You had a Dodge sponsorship for a while, I believe. So I was your buddy that had the Charger, the nice new shiny Charger.
That's right. That's right.
By trade, I'm a computer guy. I've been doing the computer stuff well over half my life, and that's kind of what I've been sticking to, since it's what I'm good at.
We are going to go ahead and jump into our next top 10. All right. This week's top 10 is the top 10 people more likely to take responsibility than Hillary Clinton. At number 10, a teenager who just wrecked his parents' car.
Oh, poor guy.
Number 9, Superman when asked about Metropolis property damage.
Ooh, that's arrogant.
Number 8, an unmarried man in a paternity case. No responsibility taken there. Now, this is one of my personal favorites. Number 7, Sean Spicer's anger management therapist.
No.
Number 6, your dog standing over an empty plate of bacon.
Yep. Or anything else.
Well, that's true. Number 5, Nancy Pelosi's plastic surgeon.
Ouch.
Number 4, a 3-year-old sitting next to an empty cookie jar.
I can relate to that.
Now, I know you guys
are... I'm going to find out about that soon.
I know you guys are both married, so you'll appreciate this one. Any woman when somebody just let one go.
Yeah. No, they don't. They usually blame us.
Number 2, Donald Trump's hairstylist.
Ouch.
And number 1, the number 1 person most likely to take responsibility more than Hillary Clinton. Bill Clinton. That's our top.
That's pretty good.
The guys are going to be sticking around with me for one more segment, so hang on for that. Before we do go to a break, I want to mention our good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. Now, these guys have been in business right here in the Montgomery region for 50 years. They have a record of customer service. They know their customers, they love their customers, and their customers love them because they do a great job. It's just as simple as that. You can bring in your car for whatever reason, no matter the make, the model. They've got somebody there that knows all about it. If you need something as rudimentary as an oil change or getting your tires rotated to major engine repair, they can always take care of you. So go by and check them out today on the Troy Highway in the south part of Montgomery today. That is Jim Woodham, Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. 860-1440 if you want to call in. We'll be right back.
The News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 13:34-35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. We've got the guys here with me just for one more segment. We got Chris and AJ in the house. So did want to bring this up since our last segment, and we were just kind of being goofy, having a little bit of fun. But we were talking about Hillary Clinton, and this is serious because she went on this interview with Kristi Ann Yamapour, CNN, one of their top political I'd call her a commentator primarily just because what she does, you can't really call journalism. So when talking to Hillary Clinton first took full responsibility for losing the election and then proceeded to blame everybody except for herself for losing the election. And so it was just something that was kind of comical to me. Hillary Clinton just started blaming the world, and I did want to get some reaction on this. So Hillary claimed out, blamed several things from people just not liking her, which, I mean, I don't blame people for not liking her. Also, she said there were aspects of sexism. She, of course, brought up the thing with James Comey. She blamed Russia. And here was my point on this. No wonder that there are a lot of Democrats out there that act like victims. Look who their role models are. You've got somebody like Hillary Clinton who lost the election and then looks for any person standing out there that she can blame other than herself. And I was wondering, what did you guys think about that? What was your reaction to all this?
I don't know. It seems like a running theme with Democrats and liberals in general. They play the blame game. You know, nobody's responsible for anything except other people. They're not responsible for their own spot in life, nothing bad that happens to them. It's never because of their own doing. It's always somebody else's fault.
It does seem like that. It seems like they're constantly hunting for somebody to blame. It's almost like if they put all the effort into blaming people that they did on actually improving themselves, they might do a lot better in the next elections. And you know, who knows, they may. But the point is, what they're doing right now, I don't feel like is moving their cause forward any, which, considering what their cause is, I'm perfectly fine with. I'm just saying that as advice to them, I would say, hey, maybe you should do a little self-reflection and not just blame everybody that's around you and blame your set of circumstances.
Get about adult that. About it.
Yeah, for sure. That's something that the Democrats have always seemed to struggle with a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this has kind of been a running theme ever since the election. I don't particularly know why the timing was made for this to come up late April, early May time frame, but this has been a running theme since the election. Blaming James Comey, which is kind of the flavor of the month, depending on your political party, whether he's for or against you. It changes all the time. I can't keep up.
That's the truth. He's been both the hero and the greatest villain of both parties, just depending on what day it is, it seems like.
Which, for a nonpartisan government employee, is actually a really good position to be in, at least from an ethics standpoint, maybe not from a personal standpoint.
Oh, exactly.
James Comey blaming people for not liking her. But it always comes back to the question, what did you do to cause that to happen? If she had been honest, if she had been responsible, if she had been this or that about all these issues that came up, the emails, the Benghazi situation, all these things that plagued her for several years before the election, a lot of that was brought on, you know, she brought that on herself. And not only that, but her behavior in handling those situations exacerbated them because she wasn't transparent, she wasn't honest, or this or that, and really just made the situation even worse. So how can you blame people for all of that when ultimately it comes back to the actions that you took that resulted in all this backlash?
Yeah, and that was one of the things that was a sticking point for me too, especially with the James Comey thing. She can blame James Comey if she wants to for her loss, for him coming out 11 days beforehand. But as I made this case yesterday on the show, in pretty much any way you can look at it objectively, James Comey was in a no-win situation and made a decision, and he opted for transparency over keeping quiet. When you have two bad decisions, it seems like opting for transparency is going to be the better solution. But furthermore, taking it one step further, blaming James Comey at this point is kind of like blaming the cop that pulls you over for doing 102 on the interstate. Well, at a certain point, you have to take a step back and look at yourself and say, well, I did get a ticket because the policeman pulled me over, but at the same time, maybe I shouldn't have been doing 102. And that seems to be the tone deafness here, is that Hillary Clinton is upset that the investigation interfered with her bid for president, but at the same time, all she had to do was not lie about her email server and turn her emails over when she was supposed to. And then this all goes away before it even starts. Then it doesn't affect the election at all, because that's 4 years ago.
Exactly.
What about the claim about Russia hacking and getting into John Podesta's emails? Because that was significant, that being her campaign manager. Do you think there's any legitimacy to that claim?
I wouldn't be surprised if something like that happens, especially if you have a personal setup. You don't quite have those government standards on a computer to try to keep it secure.
Well, now that was an interesting part of all this, because the DNC chose not to secure their servers with the FBI. The GOP did, and the difference is Russia tried to hack into both, could get into the DNC's, couldn't get into the GOP's. And so that was one thing. But on top of that, I think you also had, I do feel for Hillary Clinton slightly in this area, and here's why. Them hacking into John Podesta's emails was illegal. That's not questionable. I mean, when the Russians broke into her computer, that was an illegal action taken by a foreign power to try to affect the election. That is the case. But it's similar to the James Comey thing in that the only reason that hurt her was because of the content going on between her and her campaign managers. And so if she and her campaign managers had just been clean, if they hadn't, you know, said unsavory things about large swaths of the population, and at the same time, if they hadn't been with their campaign staff, said that they were specifically looking for people of certain minorities or people based on other external factors, then that really doesn't hurt them much either. And so, granted, in this case, I do feel more sorry for her because they shouldn't have been hacking into the John Podesta emails, but at the same time, the only reason that affected them in a negative way is that there was bad content in those emails, things that they shouldn't have been doing that affected them. And so there is a little more empathy for on my part for that. But at the same time, again, there's an easy solution, which is just be a better candidate.
Yeah, that was my thought as far as being a politician. Not that I have any experience, and hopefully I never will, being a politician. But I think, especially in this day and age, you have to treat your communications, especially at the higher levels of government, when you can be asked for anything at any point, you have to treat your communications like they are public, because most likely they will become public at some point, whether through your own intentions or someone else's, or even through some illegal means. It's quite likely that the things you say in private will become public in some way, and you have to consider that when you're communicating with people.
Well, absolutely, and that goes back to, I know we're getting out of the realm of legality or even politics, but we're going back to a principle here, which is character is how you act when no one's looking. And if Hillary Clinton and her staff were people of character, then it really wouldn't have mattered if they hacked into her email, because they would have been acting the same behind the scenes as they would have out in public. And so then there's really not an issue going on there. But unfortunately for them, they didn't have character. Reading those emails kind of showed their true colors. We had that information with their strategy and the way that they planned this, them sneaking around, getting questions, colluding with the media, that kind of thing. And because of that, that's what really hurt her public opinion in that. I think that in a lot of ways, it goes back to just if you had been a better person all around instead of just trying to put on a face. I think that's what showed the American people not only that there were some unsavory things going on, but at the same time that she's two-faced about it on top of it, which makes it even worse, in my opinion. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think she had a major authenticity, sincerity issue.
Oh, absolutely. Now, the last thing I did want to talk about before we go to another break is she essentially blamed sexism for her loss. And if you break down what she's actually saying, she's saying that there is a large section of the population that is so averse to having a female be the leader of the free world that they opted to vote for Donald Trump, regardless of his policies or the differences they had with themselves and Hillary Clinton in that case, that it was just purely because she was a woman they chose not to vote for her. And so I wanted to, does anyone really believe that the country is that sexist? I mean, do y'all buy into that claim at all?
No, not really. I wouldn't say so. Well, it was kind of strategic the way it all happened. Trump has been portrayed as being anti-woman, so she kind of used that to her advantage.
So you're saying, if anything, the fact that she was a woman probably helped her, obviously not enough to win the election, but you think that it actually might have been advantageous to her in a lot of ways?
It could have been if she played her cards right.
Fair enough. This was one of the things that I wanted to ask y'all, because when I heard that, my immediate reaction was, well, there are several women that I would have voted for. In fact, not in this election, but in the last one, my top choice was Michelle Bachmann. And so my number one pick out of the GOP primary was a woman. I don't have a problem with a woman being president, but I do care which woman it is. I don't just want to throw in just any woman just to say that I voted for a woman and that proves that I'm not sexist. So the person does matter. It's not, and I think even Bill Maher said the other day in this interview that the Democrat Party has to get away from the identity politics because people are starting to see through it. So I just wanted to ask y'all, are there any women that y'all would be okay with having as president?
Leia Organa.
May the 4th was yesterday.
Right, so of course AJ has to go with the Star Wars reference. I understand that.
I didn't agree with, for example, Carly Fiorina on a ton of things, but as far as leadership goes, I didn't think she was a terrible candidate.
Well, now, as I recall, Chris, you were a Ted Cruz supporter, and she was Cruz's running mate, so, I mean, you actually did support a woman for vice president.
Yeah, I think she's probably, as far as the candidates, going back to the, you know, the whole 17-person field.
Right.
She was probably in my top five. I would have to do some more research, but if someone just came up and said Condoleezza Rice, I would be very interested.
Mm-hmm.
I have to do more research. I guess that's kind of how I approach it, is I don't want to comment on any potential candidate, regardless of any minority status or not, because I want to know what their beliefs are. And that's kind of where it came down with me.
That's your problem, Chris. You're supposed to just vote for women or minorities just because they're women or minorities. See, that's the problem. You're into that old backwards thinking of where you want to vote for people based on merit and character.
Oh, sorry.
See, that was my
issue with Hillary Clinton. I mean, I can't support a candidate who wants to push abortion, for example. So that kind of ruled her out right there.
We do have to go to a break. Thank you so much, guys, for being with me today, and appreciate your comments. When you're looking at it from an objective standpoint, you want candidates running for the White House that have character and to vote for them based on their merit. And in this particular contest, Hillary Clinton didn't have that. And that's, to me, the biggest reason that she lost, even against the most unpopular candidate that's ever run for president in American history. And so it's a shame to see that if the Democrat Party as a whole, even if Hillary Clinton never does some self-reflection and has kind of a, maybe I could have done some things different. Even if she never does that, I think the Democrat Party certainly should at this point if they want to win the next election. All right, guys, we're going to be right back to the Patriot Preacher. Call in 860-1440.
In a white room with black curtains near the station. Black roof country, no gold payments, tired starlings.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
A watchful eye must be kept on ourselves, lest, while we're building ideal monuments of renown and bliss here, we neglect to have our names enrolled in the annals of heaven. James Madison.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. The Nerd Herd had to move on because they, in their words, had real jobs. So they had to actually get back to work. But
well, they're interesting.
Yeah, they're good folks. I've had Chris on before. AJ, I think, has called in once before, but he's never actually been a guest on the show like he was just then. So it's good to have them. They're buddies that I met in college. They try to stay informed on stuff. They'll probably be joining me at least occasionally on Fridays from here on out.
They're OBS.
Yes, we're all OBS, all of us.
OBS. Why don't y'all like to be called OBS?
I don't mind being called an OB.
Oh.
I call myself an OB.
John Longshore says that y'all don't like it, but...
Well, Longshore also tries to use, he says, burner or barners instead of, to make the joke about the barn, which I never had a problem with. I was an ag guy, and I spent half my time in college in a barn, so, it doesn't bother me.
Do you remember, in fact, it burned down that old gym, the basketball arena that burned down during the LSU game? They called it the barn.
My dad was at that game when it burned down.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, he was in school at Auburn at the time. So, anyway. But,
not
yeah.
long ago, huh?
No,
I was watching on... I don't know, ESPN or whatever.
Right.
They didn't know what was happening.
It just burned. Yeah, it was crazy happening during the game like that. But anyway, did want to get into something, and we actually have a news clip, which I'll play here in a second. So, Joe, if you want to go ahead and start working on that. There was an episode of Bill Nye, because you remember Bill Nye used to have the show, Bill Nye the Science Guy. It was a show that I watched a lot. A lot of millennials grew up watching Bill Nye. He had those... He had those little 30-minute shows that they would talk about science. Well, Bill Nye has a deal with Netflix. For those of you who have Netflix, he has his old show on that he used to do back in the day, and then he's also got a new show where it's a Netflix exclusive called Bill Nye Saves the World. Now, about 2 weeks ago on this new show, he and some actress, I think she's on a show on the CW. I didn't recognize her. I guess I just don't watch that show. But it was some actress. Apparently it was a big deal and people know her, but I had no idea who she was. They did this comedy bit to where they were going back and forth, and they were doing some kind of song, a music video as it were. And they were talking about, I forget what the title is, you can look it up on YouTube, but it's something about, pardon the crassness here, but My Sex Junk. And the whole thing revolved around your genitalia does not determine your gender. And so they did this music video to, quote unquote, educate and inform people, which, saying this as a student of broadcasting, this was my major at Auburn. I've been studying this stuff since I was a little kid. This may be the worst moment in broadcasting history. It was just that terrible. Like, it's one thing for something for me to disagree with, but if I disagree with it and it's funny, I can still laugh at it. This was neither funny nor even mildly entertaining. And so it's one thing to do that, but yeah, Joe, you can check it out in the news clips. It'll be in the folder marked today. So you just have to backtrack a little bit there. But anyway, so they have this clip, and in this particular bit, the show is, that's just one extreme example of it, but they basically entered into the realm of political activism. And so they're not even really doing science anymore or talking about science. I mean, that's the way it's presented, but they're really just doing leftist stuff now. It's essentially propaganda, because you'll notice in that little entertainment segment, there was absolutely nothing that had anything to do with science or scientific theory whatsoever. Now, I guess apparently Bill Nye is ashamed of real science because he has been censoring his old show when it contradicts his new show. And so his old show was talking about, in this one particular case, and hopefully Joe can find the clip there.
Actually, I'm having trouble finding the one that says today.
Yeah, you're supposed to backtrack a little bit more. It'll be in audio files, news clips, and then Patriot Preacher, and you'll see the date there. So hopefully we can get that pulled up. But just so you know, Bill Nye has been censoring his old program, and he has been... there was this one episode where they're talking about genes and how your genes determine who you are, and they go into a lecture on chromosomes, and they were talking about how chromosomes affect who you are and affect your gender. And so in this old episode, the girl's giving a very brief, I think it's like 2 minutes, something like that, she's giving this brief explanation about how gender works, and they censored it out. Now, I understand if they censored out something old that was controversial, but, well, I'll let you decide. Go ahead, take a listen. This is the original content that was edited from the Netflix version. This was Bill Nye back in the 90s.
When Hillary Clinton was asked at the event if misogyny played a role...
Joe, that's not it. That's the clip from yesterday. Today's the 5th. So...
Cinco de Mayo.
Right.
Yeah, my fault. Hold on just a minute.
Yeah,
we'll get that bad boy up.
So, yeah, we'll try to find that. But anyway... just kind of in a holding pattern right here. But with everything that Bill Nye has been going on, it just gives you a little indication of, you know, this is actual science, settled science from back in the day. And this was on Bill Nye's program. It's not Bill Nye speaking. It's one of the girls that was helping him on the show. But it is, I mean, it's his program. He's the one that sanctioned it. So here it is, the uncensored version of the Bill Nye episode.
I'm a girl. Could have just as easily been a boy, though, because the probability of becoming a girl is always 1 in 2. See, inside each of our cells are these things called chromosomes, and they control whether we become a boy or a girl. Your mom has 2X chromosomes in all of her cells, and your dad has 1X and 1Y chromosome in each of his cells. Before you're born, your mom gives you one of her chromosomes, and your dad gives you one of his. Mom always gives you an X. And if dad gives you an X too, then you become a girl. But if he gives you his Y, then you become a boy. See, there are only 2 possibilities. XX, a girl, or XY, a boy.
Okay, so you want to talk about settled science? That's settled science. We've known about chromosomes and how men and women work, what determines whether you're a guy or a girl, for a really long time now. Yet somehow, conservatives and people like me, we're the science deniers. But Bill Nye is taking actual scientific information off of his old show because it contradicts what he believes now. Now, here's the thing about all this. And one of the things that it said in there that I love, there are only 2 possibilities, boy or girl. Which, shouldn't be controversial. I mean, that's the way that it is. There's only two, not 58, regardless of what Facebook says. So there's not just an unlimited amount of options when it comes to gender. You're either a man or a woman. Now, maybe there's occasionally a mutation or some kind of apparition that happens, but those are extremely rare, and those are abnormal cases. So under normal circumstances, a healthy baby will be either male or female and have either two X chromosomes or an XY chromosome. And the thing is, your DNA, even if you wind up having the quote-unquote sex change surgery, you're still going to have two X chromosomes or an XY chromosome for the rest of your life. Like I've said before, your chromosomes do determine your gender. Even if you have surgery to augment your body. Because if you go into the future 1,000 years and an anthropologist digs up your bones and takes a DNA sample, he could just look at your skeleton and tell by the shape, because men and women are that different. He could tell by the shape of the hips and everything whether or not you're a man or a woman, and he could determine that. So no matter what you do, even long after your death, when your remains are found, you will still have the DNA of a man or a woman. That will never change. That's how it works. That's what you're born with, and that's what you're stuck with. For the same reason, and I know that it's always controversial when you bring race into it, if you're black, you can't change that. If you're Asian, you can't change that. If you're white, you can't change that. You could theoretically put on makeup, dye your skin, but at the end of the day, genetically, you're still what you are. That's just the card that you're dealt. That's what you have for the rest of your life. Now, that doesn't mean that you're subject to certain beliefs or certain to behaviors or anything like that, but when it comes to your genetics, you don't get to decide that. So here's the thing. Why would Bill Nye censor his old show? Because he no longer agrees himself, and so he's got to change it. Now, here's the thing. Was he wrong back then, or is he wrong now? That's the question he should be asking himself. Was I wrong then, or am I wrong now? And he didn't come out and correct it. He just censored it and hoped nobody would notice. Because here's the thing. It is okay to be wrong and then later correct yourself in science. In fact, it happens all the time. That's part of the scientific process. You come up with a hypothesis, you test that hypothesis, turns out you were wrong, you're like, okay, I was wrong, I'll come up with another one and try to prove what it really is. That's not what Bill Nye did. When Bill Nye censored his old show, it was not about science, it was not because he came up with new evidence or new data, it wasn't that he made some scientific discovery through research, it was that he changed his feelings. His feelings changed, so he changed what he believed. Well, the truth doesn't change based on your feelings. And I relate this all the time to the scripture. We're going to talk about this in a second. It doesn't matter how you feel about Jesus Christ. He is still the Lord. It doesn't matter how you feel about what the Bible says. The Bible still says what it says. There are eternal truths that do not change. And when you're talking about science, sometimes we come up with discoveries. Sometimes we learn things that we didn't know beforehand, and that changes your opinion. But your feelings don't change that. People felt like the world was flat for a very long time. Didn't change it from being round. It was always round. Perception doesn't, I mean, you know, perception may be reality in media, and by that I mean that's part of the media theory, that the way people see things is how they react to them, and that's true. But it doesn't change the truth. Certain things are one way or the other way. And that's what the case is here with gender. But Bill Nye doesn't like that, and he doesn't agree with himself anymore, so he felt like he would just fly under the radar, change his old show, and pretend like nobody, or I guess hope, that nobody would notice. See, to him, this is an inconvenient truth, pun intended. So, this is the big problem with it. He ignores inconvenient science to fit his beliefs instead of changing his inconvenient beliefs to fit science. And yet, somehow, we're the science deniers, the people who question whether or not global warming, for example, is settled science. But something that we've known for decades, understood the human genome and how gender works. We're the science deniers, even though he's the one actually censoring out science from his old programming. It's quite a hypocrite. All right, Star Spangled Sermon coming up next. Questions of science,
science and pro. This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Matthew Matthew 22:37-40. And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets."
Welcome back. You are listening to the Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. Call in 860-1440 if you want to weigh in, but you're probably going to have to wait till next week because we have the Star Spangled Sermon coming up. But speaking of our callers, we did have that biscuits giveaway, and I want to say congratulations to Seth, who called in earlier on the show. You have just won a two-pack for the biscuits game on May the 12th. They'll be playing the Chattanooga Lookouts, be right here at home in Riverwalk Stadium, just a stone's throw from the studio. So congratulations to Seth. Hopefully you'll be able to enjoy that game. I'll try to make it out to that one myself because I know we've got some fans of the show that listened in, and I'd love to go by and meet you, not just Seth, but also Tim and who was our other winner? Do you remember?
Curtis.
Curtis, that's right, Curtis. So we've got Tim.
Well, my mind is still functioning.
Yeah, there we go. Tim, Curtis, and Seth. So congratulations to you guys. We're very much looking forward to seeing you out there. Hopefully you'll enjoy those tickets with our great partners, the Montgomery Biscuits. You can check out all 140 games right here on News Radio 1440. Now, into the Star-Spangled Sermon, I'm just going to go ahead and jump straight into the passage that we're going to be dealing with today. Let's look at Luke 9:57-62, and really the only thing you need to know about this passage is that Jesus is teaching and he's interacting with some of the people that have heard his speech and are interested in being his followers. So let's delve right into the scripture. Luke 9:57-62. "As they were going along the road, someone said to him, 'I will follow you wherever you will go.' And Jesus said to him, 'The foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head.' And he said to another, 'Follow me.' And he said, 'Lord, permit me first to go and bury my father.' But he said to him, 'Allow the dead to bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim everywhere the kingdom of God.' Another also said, 'I will follow you, Lord, but first permit me to go say goodbye to those at home.' But Jesus said to him, 'No one, after putting his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God.'" This is Jesus being kind of harsh here. And that's not really an image that we like to conjure up in our head of Jesus sometimes. Sometimes we like to, because it's easier for us to focus on the loving, compassion, openness of Jesus. And that's truly a part of his personality as well. But we also have to consider passages like this, which are just as much part of the gospel as those passages. Why would Jesus talk to new converts like this? Because these are people that have not been following him. They've just now heard the gospel for the first time. Wouldn't talking to them this harshly discourage them? Yes, it would. And that's why he did it. You see, Jesus was loving, he was compassionate, he was gentle, but he was also unapologetically honest. He didn't want to give them some flowery image in their head of what the Christian walk was going to be like. When he taught to people, he told them about God's love, about his mercy, about the rewards that come to those. But he also said, guys, this is not going to be easy. The Christian life is not for the faint of heart. And if that's what you're expecting, if you're expecting a slow, gentle walk in your life, then Christianity is not for you. He was unapologetically honest with these new disciples. And these disciples, they needed to know up front that Christianity is a grueling path over treacherous, hostile terrain. It's not an easy walk. It's not a short sprint. It takes time and effort, and it's going to be the hardest thing that you ever do. But what if he had held off on telling the truth until they discovered it for themselves? What if Jesus hadn't said it this way? What if Jesus had had a PR degree, and he had basically built it up in their minds to get them to get involved in Christianity? Well, what happens when they discover that, oh, this really isn't easy? Man, this actually is pretty tough. What would have happened to them then? See, then they would have been more discouraged and depressed because they were sold a bill of goods that was not correct. And when that happened, and I think this is a trap that a lot of Christians fall into, when that happens and they realize, oh, this isn't easy, it's not all sunshine and roses, I think we as people tend to get discouraged, and sometimes we even feel like we're doing it wrong, because maybe other people surrounding us, they seem to have everything together, and and they're living this wonderful, cushy life, and that's not what Christianity is. Well, that's not the fault of us. Jesus ensures us that we will be persecuted, that we are going to face very difficult trials, that we're going to face opposition. In fact, if we're not facing opposition, we're doing something wrong. So we're actually doing something wrong if we don't face those things. And it was important that Christ told them about this so that they knew that that was going to happen. You see, you think about the people in the prosperity gospel, it's too shallow. That's why they don't stay with it very long. Because the second adversity comes up, they're like, oh, well, this wasn't what I was promised. And a lot of them fall away very quickly. Jesus didn't do that. He told them it was going to be tough up front. Jesus knew that if they could not clear the first hurdle, they might as well not even start the race. If they didn't know up front that you're getting into something that's going to be very difficult, there's no sense in even trying. They had to be able to take on that first hurdle of Christ being honest with them and telling them, this is not going to be easy for you. And that's exactly what Christ says to us. It's rewarding, but it's also very tough. Have a good week. Stay the course, friends.
The Patriot Preacher on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.